In Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, co-authors Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman argue that when it comes to raising children, we have mistaken good intentions for good ideas, and that many of our modern society's strategies for nurturing children are backfiring. The book, which is published by 12, reveals new science and research about how praise doesn't always have a positive result and how our attempts to raise tolerant, honest kids can sometimes fail. I'm very pleased to welcome Poe Bronson back to our show today. It's always a pleasure to see you.
It's great to be here today in the city.
Don't most parents raise their kids the way that they were raised?
I think a lot of parents tell me that they either are doing one of two things. They're sort of following their parents, they feel that was good, or they're proud to be doing something quite different, which is very often proud to be much more affectionate, praising their kids in the way they weren't praised. They remember that it felt good to be praised. And they're sort of, in many dimensions, doing the opposite of the sort of authoritarian parents that they had.
Well, the only way we can even learn to parent usually is to watch what our parents did and either say, I'm going to do that because I think that works, or I'm not going to do that because I think it was a terrible mistake.
If you remember that, there's this interesting research on progressive dads, and they were looking at middle school kids and they were saying, which ones act up in class? And then they did polling of their fathers, and there were progressive dads who you would think would have smoked their competition because they were up against sort of these authoritarian fathers and up against really what are deadbeat or distant dads. And on most levels, the progressive dads did indeed. You would think they had doing a lot better than the other dads. But on two key variables, they weren't. Their kids were acting up in class as much as the children of the deadbeat dads. And
the other kids were scared to act up in class because they were going to be punished when they
got
home.
Well, maybe, but what it seemed to do was about inconsistency of discipline at home. That the progressive dad is a great dad, you know, set up wear the beanie on the chest and, you know, set up the port-a-crib and no problem, change a diaper one-handed. But when it comes to disciplining their child, progressive dads are sort of embarrassed to do it, weren't counting on having to do this as part of fatherhood, and as a result are often very inconsistent. And it's not so much how they discipline as it's the lack of knowing what works. So they're trying everything. So the inconsistency ends up leading to kids who become more socially aggressive.
Because the kids are confused. Why this time did he come down hard on me and then
right,
let me get away with it?
And why did he do, you know, withdraw this privilege at this point and then the next time decide he's going to really try to act mad at me to show me that I really did something wrong? And so monoparents, I think, are doing – the science says they're doing all sorts of wonderful things. But there are key areas in which some of the assumptions we make are contradictory to what the scientific record says.
You begin the book by explaining how praising kids isn't necessarily the best thing. Are parents praising their kids, telling them they're smart because they've been told that that's the way to raise a confident, motivated kid, or because – they wish that they had been treated that way?
See, I think it was more the latter, Leonard. I mean, certainly plenty of people who followed the self-esteem movement were hearing directly, praise your kid all the time, tell them they're smart, boost their confidence. You know, I didn't hear that personally. I was praising my child. I was telling my child he was smart. I got there sort of out of the zeitgeist. You know, and I got there out of trying to kind of do the opposite of what I imagined my parents and my grandparents had done and thinking, you know, it felt good when I was praised, so I'm going to do this to my child. It was sort of a leap of logic that I was pulling things from the zeitgeist more than any actual research study.
So tell us about the research that Dr. Carol Dweck did in this area.
Yeah, Carol had done seminal work when she was at Columbia, though she's now at Stanford, in 20 New York City schools as well as some places in the Midwest. And she would do an experiment where she'd pull kids out of the classroom and randomly divide it into groups. Kids one at a time would take a short little IQ test, and then they'd be given a single line of praise. They'd be told, wow, you did really well. You must be really smart. Or, wow, you did really well. You must have worked very hard. And then they would immediately take another just, you know, 5-10 minute IQ test, a pattern matching thing. And the kids who had been smart, you know, over the course of a series of tests started to perform worse and worse. And the kids who had been told they'd worked really hard started to do better and better. It turns out that praising kids for their intelligence teaches them this construct that intelligence is innate. And then once they begin to experience difficulty, they don't have a variable they control to help them deal with failure. Praising them for their effort highlights the idea about how hard you work, how much you roll up your sleeves.
So where did this idea that self-esteem is crucial to a child's well-being come from?
Well, back in 1952, it was The Power of Positive Thinking. And then in 1969, Nathaniel Brandon penned a book on self-esteem that was widely read. And then in 1984, there was a California legislature task force that got a lot of attention all around the country because they were saying self-esteem turns out to be the key to everything we need for kids and kids in the urban area and in wherever it might be. Well, in 2003, the American Psychological Society asked Roy Baumeister, then a leading proponent of self-esteem, to review the 15,000 studies that had been done on this thing. It became the most researched subject in all of scholarly history. And he found that it was polluted with bad science. And only 200 of the 15,000 studies had proper control groups or properly measured self-esteem in the first place, didn't just ask people what they thought of themselves, because then they're like, so high self-esteem people are likely to lie. And when he looked at all the data, he said that self-esteem doesn't correlate with anything we thought it did, and he called it one of the worst days of his professional career.
How does that affect someone like you? You were praising your kids' intelligence because you said that was part of the zeitgeist, and then you start reading this research. Do you suddenly have to shift course?
I did. I tried to stop overnight, but it was hard. You know, everybody else was praising their kids.
Well,
I mean,
you say good job to the
first,
kid.
I first wrote about this for New York Magazine in 2007, and that became widely disseminated. But back then, man, I'd go out in public and everybody else would be praising their kids. And so I'd sort of fall off the wagon. I was a social praiser again. And I eventually began to understand that there was some hypocrisy here, that praising my kid was an effort to manipulate their perception. And rather than, you know, maybe I should be honest with my child and sincere first, because only kids 7 and under take praise at face value.
So did you see a change in your kids' behavior as a result?
Oh, certainly. By focusing my children's effort and attention to their effort, to their strategies, especially by not denying failure in their lives. You know, not everything's gone great for them in elementary school, and there's moments. And when I feel like I talk to them about what went wrong and how to deal best with it next time, I'm not ignoring failure. Dr. Jennifer Crocker from the University of Michigan says, you know, not talking about failure with our kids leads kids to think that failing is so unacceptable. It's a forbidden topic in the family, and it sets an extremely high agenda for children. When we tell kids they're smart, they get the message that being smart is the only thing that counts, and they become obsessed with manipulating their image of looking smart and be afraid of taking risks that might make them look not smart.
My guest is Poe Bronson, author of 5 books, now co-author of a 6th called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. It's published by 12. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You also looked at the importance of sleep to children. How much sleep should children be getting, and how much sleep are they getting?
Well, they're getting a lot less than we think. Most people remember back when they were kids, they didn't get a lot of sleep, especially you can remember to our high school years, we didn't think we got a lot of sleep. Well, actually, we've stolen another hour out of kids' lives of sleep. So take what you might imagine you got in high school and subtract an hour. The science is quite clear that when you get, say, less than the 9 hours maybe a teenager needs, 10 hours a middle schooler might need, that first hour doesn't cause much impairment. But it's that second hour, which we've sort of unwittingly stolen from kids in the last 30 years, that's really causing problems cognitively and then with their obesity and their behavioral regulation.
Well, you said we're stealing it from the kids. Aren't the kids complaining when we try to get them to go to bed? I remember when I was a kid, the biggest fight every night was, whether it was me or my siblings, was bedtime.
Well, maybe there's all sorts of reasons why we're doing it, including children may not necessarily want to go to sleep, but also we like
to spend. And there's television now.
And there's television. We like to spend time with our kids. You know, sometimes it's a very cute hour. It's sort of like the national debt. You know, what's another 15 minutes on the bill?
Are schools aware of this change in kids' sleeping habits?
Since we wrote about this, school districts are becoming more aware of what they've done. One of the reasons that we've stolen sleep is to save money on school buses. So we used to have maybe 2 fleets, one taking elementary school kids to school and one taking high school kids to school. And by getting it down to a single fleet, if you started the high school, say, at 7:30, 7:15 in some places, 7:45, the buses can then loop around and pick up the elementary school kids and get them to by 9. And now there are districts, Wilton, Connecticut, nearby, has changed the school start time of their high school, and they saw dramatic differences in the kids by letting them sleep in a little longer.
Hasn't sleep been connected to obesity?
It's kind of strange. What would sleeping more have to do with sort of slimming your waistline? But it's during sleep that many of the hormones that regulate appetite and sort of fat burning are all regulated, especially human growth hormone, which is released during sleep. And as a result, kids who sleep more are skinnier. Kids who get less sleep are fatter. And it's remarkable. 1 hour less sleep increases the odds of obesity 80%.
So all of the other arguments are only partly true, watching too much television, eating too much junk food, not walking enough?
Well, the junk food, I think that's a legitimate thing. The television is kind of fascinating. We've long taken it for granted that watching TV is what's making kids fat. But kids have tripled in their rate of obesity in the last 30 years. And we're only watching, you know, a little bit more television and a little bit more internet. Something else is definitely going on. And it turns out when you study kids, they don't trade TV time for physical activity. They trade it for other sedentary activities. So if you turn the TV off, they wouldn't necessarily go outside and play. And there is something else going on that's driving kids' obesity that we haven't considered before.
My guest is Poe Bronson, whose articles with Ashley Merriman in New York Magazine on the science of parenting have won the Magazine Journalism Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science and a Clarion Award. Their book, which grows out of that, is called Nature Shock, New Thinking About Children. It's published by 12. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Poe Bronson, who has written with Ashley Merriman, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. It's published by 12. You looked at how children lie. Don't all kids lie at one point or another?
It's a normal developmental progression to experiment with lying, usually when a child is around 4 years old, but it could be 3 or 2.
They're testing limits?
It's not so much they're testing limits. They're simply working through theories of mind, this idea that they can hold one thought, they can report something different, they can sustain an illusion for you if they lie about something that's going on. It was simply experimentation.
Is this hardwired, or are they learning from observing their parents and other people?
Well, certainly children see their parents tell little white lies often, and parents are encouraging their children, you know, as young as 4, to lie about how they feel about the president, their grandmother got them. And, you know, we're encouraging kids to lie and modeling lying for them all the time.
So kids are taught that lying is bad, and then they're told that lying is okay under certain circumstances. We're asking them at a very young age to differentiate between a bald-faced lie and a little white lie.
And probably too young. We're also telling them all the time, don't tattle, don't tell. You know, school teachers will say that tattling or telling is sort of one of the top 5 problems they deal with at a young age. But actually, the science of tattling has even been, you know, studied. And usually kids will endure, you know, 9 infractions from a friend or a classmate before they actually report the final one to teachers or to parents. And children bring these constructs, these psychological constructs, up into middle age, where they're thinking that kids around them now middle school, and they're starting to test delinquency, and they bring this idea, don't tattle, don't tell, use white lies to sort of cover up these difficult circumstances.
Well, when does it become not a problem?
Okay.
With some kids, of course, it's going to be a problem forever,
right.
Isn't
all
it?
All kids will experiment with it. Of the kids who are 6 years old are still lying, half of them will still be lying at 7. The other half will have it socialized out of them. The kids who were still lying at 7 seem to have hang on to it then as a sort of strategy all through the middle years.
You write that out of 36 potential topics, the average teen lies to her parents about 12 of them. So that's one-third.
And this is another, this is one-third of the topics, but even the teens who lie the least, now we're talking teenagers now, not kids, their lying is something different is going on. They're seeking their autonomy. So even the best kids who lie to their parents the least will still at least withhold the facts on 5 out of 36 potential topics. It's important for some things to be none of your parents' business. Now, 78% of American parents think that their teens can tell them anything, but the kids disagree. To always come to your parent and tell the truth is sort of psychologically emasculating. It's a sign that on some way you can't handle this on your own.
The more permissive parents have told me that their kids are more open with them.
And Nancy Darling and Linda Caldwell's work proves quite clearly that's not true. Permissive parents actually don't hear more from their kids. Parents are terribly afraid of pushing their teen into outright rebellion, but that actually appears to be somewhat of a statistical myth. The parents who are sort of rules obsessed make their kids obedient, and not just obedient to the parents, actually obedient to their peers. So when their friend's saying, let's go off and get drunk and do this sort of thing, they become obedient to them as well.
So even getting a kid who's well-behaved isn't always the best thing, but even if the kid were exactly, acted exactly the way the parents wanted, isn't there something awful about that?
Yeah, children need to be prepared. Children need to be prepared for their own independence, and that's why they will carve out a life into themselves, and that means withholding some things from parents.
Well, do they tend to do that with the things that they assume the parents might disapprove of, like drinking or drugs or sex?
They're always trying to get out of trouble, so yes. And they're trying to protect the relationship with the parents, so very often they're going to withhold information or even concoct an outright lie in order to protect the sense of what the parent expects and wants from them.
Are kids less likely to abuse drugs or alcohol if they're driven and pushed to do well in school and to participate in extracurricular activities and sports?
Not necessarily. You know, it's very easy to say things are good for kids and bad for kids. But once you begin doing that, you begin to depart from the science immediately, because the science says that most things are quite complex in children's lives. And a lot of the, you know, kids who are doing well in school and are popular and have lots of friends and are well-liked are going to turn to sort of drinking and drugs at some point and experiment with it. Not quite as early as the most rebellious kids, but they'll be doing it quickly thereafter. And some do end up having problems with alcohol or problems with drugs, but you can't just we can't just pick and choose the traits we want in kids.
Well, isn't there always a risk of backlash if kids are pushed too hard to achieve?
You know, kids were pushed too hard to achieve. What's bigger concern there is that they're not learning intrinsic motivation. And so they're not orienting towards the world about things that they like, their goals. They're not developing that sort of autonomy. And it goes back to a similar thing with the praise. They become focused on this sort of image maintenance and external goals rather than their internal desire to learn.
Well, we're talking mostly about parents in relation to kids, but what about schools in relation to kids? Do drug prevention programs in schools work, or do the parents have to really be the determining factor?
Well, one of the most, the number one most popular program, DARE, which gets over $1 billion in funding, has been proven time and again to not work. When you mentioned at the top of the show, good intentions being mistaken for good ideas, people love the idea, the intention of DARE. Have police officers come into your school and teach not just a one-day thing, you know, a year-long course or a half-year course, and have the police officers directly kind of in your kid's face saying, this is what happens to people who take drugs. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. It doesn't reduce drug use at all, but we just like it so much because of its premises.
Can we even teach good behavior? I mean, for example, you talked about a study that was done in Long Island schools involving gratitude.
That's right. A great scholar there, Jeffrey Froh at Hofstra, wanted to reproduce a celebrated study by Robert Emmons, in which Emmons had college students fill out gratitude journals. And he found that the college students, after a week or two of this, were experiencing all sorts of positive emotions, and they even got more exercise and more sleep, and that their friends rated them well. And this sort of gratitude boomlet happened, where you could buy gratitude journals online, and everybody, every columnist was saying, get your kids to do gratitude exercises. And Froh thought, well, let's test that. And he also worked in the Candlewood Middle School District, and he had middle schoolers And then later on, high schoolers, middle schoolers, and elementary school students try this, working with different variety of gratitude exercises. And everybody loved this, and they even wrote it up and said it was fabulous and how great it was. But the science actually said something different. It didn't work. The kids didn't experience more gratitude overall. Now, it turns out when you look at it very closely, some kids did. Kids with low positive affect, kids who sort of were withdrawn and not very happy, doing the journals helped them. But your average good kid who felt good already, the exercises actually sort of backfired. They made them feel worse, which is really interesting.
They're feeling guilty?
Well, what could possibly be bad about making kids feel grateful? Well, we go back to, we're talking about autonomy before. And the need for autonomy, we traditionally, conventionally think of it as it's starting out at age 11 and then it's peaking at age 18. It actually peaks at age 14. The 18-year-old is already carved out of a lot of autonomy, and it's stronger in an 11 and 12-year-old than in an 18-year-old. So these middle schoolers, they want to think of themselves as independent. And if you're making them every day think about how they owe, you know, they're responsible to their parents and to their teachers and to their coaches, and they owe everybody a great debt, it's sort of undermining their need for independence and autonomy that was making them feel worse.
My guest is Poe Bronson, who's written with Ashley Merriman, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. It is published by 12. Well, self-control is a positive trait in most people, including kids. Can you describe the Tools of the Mind program and how it works to teach self-discipline?
Well, certainly. Throughout New Jersey now, because they have publicly financed preschools, there's experiments in this program called Tools of the Mind, which has kids do a lot of play. But not just play like crazy, this preschool. They plan their play. And kids as young as three sort of attempt to write down their plan for the day. And they will play for 90 minutes, but it's not random, crazy, chaotic play. They're playing firehouse. And some of the kids will be the fire truck. And some of the kids will be the call center. And some of the other kids will be the family that's being rescued. And they will sustain their play for 90 minutes at a time. And what happens is kids are inhabiting roles, and as themselves, they can't necessarily manifest self-control. They're distracted. But if they're pretending they're somebody else, they suddenly can take this on for a long period of time. And this key trait, plus the play planning, plus some exercises like Simon says, is turning the kids down in Neptune, New Jersey, and in Passaic, New Jersey, into kids who have extremely high executive function scores, which makes them very good at inhibiting their emotions, their distractions, the cognitive benefits as well, where they can avoid distractions on an intellectual basis. And they're really ready for school. And a lot of them are turning up in the gifted programs in New Jersey.
So we can actually teach good behavior.
Again, it's not teaching behavior. There's a real important difference here between making a kid be obedient and not want to sort of grab a marshmallow or grab a cookie and expecting a reward at the end of that, and making a child self-directed, which is a child who chooses what they want to do, how they want to play, or what they want to study. And they're so absorbed in that that they're not being subject to the whims and distractions of their environment. And that child is intrinsically motivated rather than sort of being obedient to a teacher. And that's the kind of kids that Tools is creating.
Parents are often concerned that violent TV shows and video games lead to more aggressive and violent behavior. What do the studies show?
Well, let's start with kids in the preschool age. What's really fascinating is that on some levels, a show like PBS's Arthur is worse for kids than Power Rangers, which is sort of very shocking and counterintuitive. And it turns out that Arthur's and shows like it, educational television in general, first, they still have a lot of insults in them. And in addition, they teach kids relational aggression, how to be socially dominant, how to be really bossy. So kids who watch these shows are learning bossiness. And most kids who are watching what we think of as violent kids' fare wrap that idea in the realm of pretend play, which they don't actually take to their real social interactions. So they're sort of safely in the bubble there.
Well, is spanking likely to lead to more aggression?
Okay, this is long term. We'd always thought in the social sciences that kids who were spanked more were more aggressive, but we didn't necessarily know which was causing which. And the newest science, which is looking at cross-cultural around the globe, where spanking is perhaps even more common in some other cultures, and we first teased this out, the scholars did, Ken Dodge did, by comparing African-American families against what he was finding in Caucasian families, is that it's not necessarily the spanking itself. Kids who've been spanked a little don't necessarily turn out worse, in some ways turn out better than kids who've never been spanked. What's different is that certainly in white families, when there's the rare spanking, the parent is usually lost it. They're mad and they're emotional. So when you spank in that situation, you're saying to the kid, you are socially taboo. What you've done is so bad. This is, you get the special punishment. You're that bad. Maybe in an African-American community, which doesn't necessarily spank more often, but it's spanking is seen as the normal thing kids go through. So to get it, it's not as, you're not being labeled in the same way. And so you see these very different findings, and no scholar, clearly, no scholar is saying it's okay to spank your kids or we should spank our kids. They're just saying it's not as simple as we thought, that spanking is what leads to childhood aggression.
What is the situation for aggressive kids? Do they tend to, do other kids tend to stay away from them?
That's fascinating because, you know, we hear a lot about bullies and we're very concerned about childhood aggression in schools. But we can't simply label it because most of the aggression in schools is coming from popular kids who are treated by others with awe and respect and reverence. And and while we think that their behavior sort of it really bothers us as parents to hear about it. Your kid comes home and he's telling you a story. Most of the aggressive behavior is coming from these sort of socially dominant kids, but those socially dominant kids in most cases are actually very pro-social, and they're twice as pro-social as aggressive. So the same kid who maybe, you know, made your kid feel bad is also the kid who invites them over, organizes groups, includes them. Some kids turn out to be just very socially busy, and they're doing both good behavior and bad behavior.
Although this changes when kids become teenagers, boys and girls act very differently. There is that phenomenon of the mean girls. Boys when they're younger, mean girls when they're teenagers.
Right, but Nikki Crick's work has also shown that girls can be aggressive, especially relationally aggressive.
Just one other thing. We're told that you want to enrich an infant's life by playing it great music and talking to it a lot. Does that work?
It does. Talking to your child is important. But really fascinating science out of Cornell by Michael Goldstein and Jennifer Schwad, and here at NYU by Kathy Tamas Lamonda, is showing this amazing new insights into how infants acquire language, and it's more about how you watch what comes out of the child's mouth and reinforce it with a touch or a stroke of a word rather than channeling a whole bunch of words into their ears.
And your co-author, Ashley Merriman, tried the Goldstein approach, and it worked, obviously.
She was trying work from Jen Schwad with motionese, where you're talking to a one-year-old to teach them a novel word, and you move the object around while saying it.
Poe Bronson will be at the Barnes & Noble store at Union Square on Wednesday at 7 o'clock, and then at the Wilton Library in Wilton, Connecticut at 12 noon tomorrow, also at 7 o'clock at the R.J. Julia Bookstore in Madison, Connecticut tomorrow. All details, in case you didn't write all that down, can be found on our show page at WMIC.org. The book, Nature Shock, New Thinking About Children, is published by 12. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
On tomorrow's show, former Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge addresses the controversy around his new book. And then Kaylee Jones stops by to talk about her memoir, Lies My Mother Never Told Me, growing up with the celebrated writer James Jones and a very troubled mother. Also, Eric Repair, the chef and owner of the famed Le Bernardin restaurant, talks about his new PBS series. And New York Times restaurant critic Frank Bruni on how he developed a healthy love of food after decades of weight problems. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angela Sheldon and Nicole Silversack. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.